Hello and welcome to Spotlight Middle East. I'm your host, Sarah Musa. Entering its fourth year, the Syrian conflict still remains unresolved. Even though Geneva II held promise for creating a common platform for the Syrian opposition, Bashar al-Assad's regime, and other participant parties to discuss Syria's future, the efforts could not reach fruition. Political divisions and the lack of a common military strategy among opposition groups were the reasons why a transitional government has not yet been formed in Syria up until today as well. Meanwhile, the attitude of international backers should be underlined while the U.S., Turkey, and some of the Persian Gulf countries such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar have been supporting different opposition groups. Russia and Iran, along with Hezbollah, have been supporting al-Assad regime. The fragile process in Syria is still waiting for a solution, which is becoming more and more difficult as time passes. In today's episode, we'll spotlight the latest events in Syria with our dear guest, Secretary General of Arab National Forum, Dr. Ziad Al-Hafiz. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. We'll move on to our report, see the latest in Syria. We'll watch it together.
In one of the fierce battles in Syria, Syrian army units regained control of Al-Samra village in northern parts of Latakia. They controlled the police station of Al-Samra after tough battles against the militants. They also continued their advances in Maliha town and Damascus countryside. The army units killed a number of notorious militants from the terrorist groups. Filaq al-Rahman, al-Ittihad al-Islami, al-Anjad al-Sham, Islamic Front, and al-Nusra Front. Syrian troops took control of al-Ramusi district in the northwestern province of Aleppo and killed scores of militants in different parts of it. Army units also succeeded in destroying several militant hideouts across the western province of Homs. The report noted, adding that many militants were killed and their weapons were destroyed. Similar operations were also conducted in the provinces of Da'ad, Hama, Latakia and Idlib. Development came a day after the Syrian government forces took control of al-Matahan area near the city of Aleppo, following fierce battles with militants. On the other side, Syria is planning for a free and transparent election on June 3, and by that dismissing Western and opposition accusations regarding the upcoming presidential polls. Under the Syrian constitution, the presidential election should be held up to 3 months before the end of Assad's presidency. Assad's 7-year presidential term ends in July.
Dr. Ziad Al-Hafiz, how do you see the situation in Syria today, and especially when speaking about the presidential elections and the path of the elections?
Well, I think the step that the Syrian government has taken to go ahead with the election as scheduled is an indication that their fortunes on the ground will allow them to do so. And of course, this is triggering the reaction by the opposition and, of most importantly, the countries, regional and international, that are sponsoring these opposition forces to trying to dismiss the elections. Actually, the problem is the following, is on one hand, they're not confident that any candidate will be able to defeat President Assad. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, having the elections is an indication that the government has restored its sovereignty all over or most of the parts of Syria, which goes against the claim that the opposition, if you read Western media and certain Western reports, these reports would indicate that the government is only in certain areas and the rest of the country is within or under the mm-hmm. control of armed groups. So on one hand, they don't want to see any candidate, or they cannot see any candidate who can defeat President Assad. On the other hand, having the election is a sign that the government is controlling. So either way, their political endeavors are facing a deadlock.
Definitely. We're seeing a little bit of dilemma in their stances. We hear Ban Ki-moon speaking of democracy and speaking of right presidential elections and set on time. However, on the other hand, we find them opposing that, claiming that it will not be democratic because they are opposing the path of Bashar al-Assad.
Well, you see, the track record of these countries that are opposing the elections are not exactly keen on democracy. In the region, we had several elections where the outcome was not really to the taste of these powers. For instance, in Lebanon, we had Hezbollah winning, and they do not consider it as a legitimate action. In Gaza and in the West Bank, Hamas won the election, and they followed. It was followed by a boycott by the Western powers. In other words, democracy with them is you get the people we want you to get, that's all. So their claim for democracy is really quite disingenuous, as long since the outcome of democratic process is not to their liking.
Is that why we're seeing a little bit of opposition forces not taking and standing by the electoral process? Is it fear of the West or fear of some pressure?
Yes, I think the domestic opposition, the one that has not really mortgaged its future, so to speak, to regional or international powers, are between a rock and a hard place. They may be willing to participate into the process, but the pressure that they have been facing from rival groups, armed groups on the ground, and as well as the international opposition, is and regional countries and major powers in Europe and the United States really are not allowing them to have their free say. So in a sense, they have been marginalized, not necessarily by the government, but by the people who are supposed to back any opposition. I mean, the opposition has to be following the agenda that these regional powers and international powers are dictating. The domestic opposition does not really have the same agenda, and that's why they are not really particularly.
So basically you're saying that the opposition themselves are split into two parts, a part that is actually sticking to a different agenda, that of the Western, that is also imposing on the other parts.
Absolutely. I think that's what you see in the opposition that is seated outside Syria. They have a totally different agenda domestically, regionally, and internationally. Some of the claims or the position that have been attributed to such opposition will not be able to sit well with the Syrian people, especially if, as far as the relations with the future of the relation between Syria and the Zionist entity. It seems that certain parts are willing to accommodate the Zionists and eventually to drop their claims on the Golan and other things. Whereas the domestic opposition, no, does not have the same agenda, and actually on its foreign policy is pretty much more or less in tune with the positions of the current government. So it is a question only of domestic freedoms, domestic reforms, that there is a bone of contention between such opposition and the current government. But the other opposition, we have seen in the last quote-unquote elections that have brought the members of the coalition, you can see that they are totally manipulated by the sponsoring country, the one that are financing them, providing them shelter and providing them political coverage, and providing them also the access to the media to make their case. But they have failed miserably in the last Geneva meeting, and they could not really foster their agenda because their agenda is totally unrealistic. It is not congruent with what they're doing on the battlefield. You cannot get in negotiations what you have failed to achieve on the battlefield. So their view of a transitional government is a government where President Assad has no say whatsoever. Well, if you can do it on the ground, then you can impose it, but you have not been able to achieve that, so why on earth would the government accede to your demands? And also the fact is that to a large extent, the opposition, this outside opposition, has managed to give coverage to the, political coverage to the the fundamentalists, the
Definitely.
More intransigent groups, and they actually these are the ones who are dominating the political, the military landscape on the opposition side. So the government at Geneva said, let's agree on one agenda, that we have first to eradicate or contain terrorism. And of course, they did not want to accept
that. But
that's
not happening on ground, as you just mentioned. The talks were different than that of what is being sold on the battlefield.
Yes, exactly. And so now the government has a very clear political agenda saying, we are here to eradicate terrorism, and which will make it very difficult for outside powers to say no to that, because those members who are, those armed groups are coming from these particular countries. So what will be this, what will happen if once these people return to their own countries, what will happen? This is a major concern. And that's why we have seen a shift in the official policies of several regional and international powers. Of course, they have not completely
Of course, one of them is Saudi Arabia, speaking of which, we had Bandar bin Sultan being, he said that he resigned, but actually he was pulled out by the Saudi government, royal
exactly.
family.
Exactly, and you still have a continuation of the policy, in fact, an escalation by the Turkish. But on the other hand, the Americans, if you follow the U.S. media mainstream and also the publications of think tanks, they have come to a conclusion that the regime is not going to fall as they thought. It is much stronger. And the pragmatism, the ever-long passing pragmatism of the Americans, if you can't beat them, join them. So that's why we're waiting for the appropriate atmosphere to re-engage with the Syrian government. Nowadays, they are doing it indirectly through the Iranians.
Mm-hmm. And through the Russians as well. Perhaps.
And, well, the Russians, they have been, but there are factions within the U.S. administration that do not want to see a strengthening of the understanding between President Obama and President Putin. So the events in Ukraine.
Ukraine, the Crimea, over the Crimea.
Have been designed in order to destabilize this relationship that saw at its height the chemical agreement and the agreement over the nuclear program in Iran. So that did not sit well with the with certain factions that are really tied with the IPAC, the Israeli lobby, and to a large extent also financed with certain Saudi money. So they have managed to stir up these the events in Ukraine, and the relationship between the American and the Russian government are quite strained. So barring that, I think there is an overall movement toward a de-escalation of tensions in the region, and it is only a matter of time while this will be translated into concrete or tangible actions on the battlefield in Syria. We have seen, for instance, the recent successes of the Syrian army and their ability to identify and neutralize the leaders of the armed groups, which show that they have been benefiting from solid intelligence in that respect. There was, of course, the intelligence of the Syrian army, but I think there are also other sources for that intel where you can see the conversion of interest that foreign powers, regional or international, really do not want to see these armed groups return back home and cause trouble there.
Definitely. That's something that they didn't calculate at the beginning of the path that you drew towards Syria and, of course, the region. Allow us to move on to our first break, and we'll be back. More to go on Spotlight Middle East. Stay tuned.